Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking home. As always, I'm joined by my co-host and the man who spends more time here than he does anywhere else, Martin McMahon. How are you, buddy?
Thanks very much, Tony. Yeah, great. Listen, little patron shout here. The more patrons we have, the more pods we can put out. It's a vicious circle. We need the money in.
You know, that's the discouragement to people. I think we put out enough pods.
So please jump on board, become a patron. Thanks very much.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Midwest, spokesperson for housing and author of Home, Why Public Housing is the Answer. Owen O'Brien, Owen, how are you doing, buddy?
Not too bad. I was enjoying the sunshine before I came into this dark and tortoise shack, but no, it's good to be here as always.
Yeah, we've changed a few things since the last time you were in, all right, and Martin's right, actually. This is all done by patrons.
So, every bit.
Yeah. So thank God for them. We're going to go straight into the book. Like, I've read the book and I've, you know, it's not going to shock anybody to realize that I think a lot of the suggestions in it are terrific. But what I did find impactful was actually particularly the testimonies from the beginning where you analyzed stories of different people. And I'm going to go and personalize this back to myself in the day job as someone who was involved in the banks and the standard financial statements that people were forced to fill out and whether they were dealing with MABs and all of this. Can I ask you, as a person, as an author, as a TD, did that stuff take a toll on you?
Look, one of the things a constituency TD does is spend a lot of time working with constituents who have problems, whether they're social welfare problems or legal problems. And obviously, housing is one of the biggest issues for most of us these days. I think it's a double-edged sword in the sense that, like, on a Friday when I do most of my appointment clinics, I have a lot of families, particularly working families at the moment, presenting either imminently at risk of homeless or who have become homeless. And while there are days where that can be a bit emotionally draining, I get to go home at 6 or 7 o'clock on a Friday and they don't. And I think it also gives you a bit of perspective that whatever difficulties I might find, it's nowhere close to the difficulties these families are having. With respect to the start of the book, I suppose, look, it's a book about housing policy. And even though nerds like me are incredibly excited about housing policy, for the regular, normal person, it's a lot of facts, it's a lot of figures, there's a lot of history. So what I wanted to do at the start of the book is just very clearly set out that this book is about real people. Mm. And no matter how many numbers or tables or reports that I make reference to, let's not forget at any point that in a book which is about how dysfunctional our housing system is, we have to remember, for example, the pensioner imminently at risk of losing his rental home after 20 years, the single mother stuck in a damp-ridden box bedroom of her mum's council house with her two kids, the young couple who are desperate to save for their home but are forced to live apart because they can't rent because it's so expensive. And I think if those of us who are involved in housing policy never forget those real people, I think you're probably going to produce better quality policy. And that's, I suppose, why I started with those real stories. They're not fictional. They are from my constituency clinic, obviously anonymized, but they're the people who are being left behind by the mess that we all know exists out there.
Well, I suppose I can say that I know from my own first-hand thing that they're even some of the tamer examples of some of the stuff that we've seen caused by market-led solutions. But you do, I'd say, about 45 pages, I'm right to say, of a walkthrough of Irish housing history in it. And it's very good because it takes away the idea of, oh, look, this is how we always did things, and this is how, and Martin will tell you, he'll bear witness to this. I remember when the state were drawing back from building social housing, the banks were moving in with the financial impetus, and you go through that quite well. And as someone who was on the ground floor doing it, I mean, I was the first person to introduce 100% mortgages into Ireland within these parameters that we were first doing them. And I could actually see it happening, and I knew, but I didn't realize the chaos that we were doing and the gap in the market. Do you think that, giving that context, to your credit, do you think that giving that context gives the likes of the Department of Housing and the new models that are still sort of market driven, can we take any learnings from those to what we're doing today?
Yeah, I mean, look, the central idea of the book is to say our housing system is dysfunctional. So to ask the question, why is it dysfunctional? When did it become like that? And then, as we'll get onto in a few minutes, what you can do to change it. Mm. So I do think it's important that we understand the history. Now, I have to say that section of the book, that 40 or 50 pages, is based on really, really good primary research by other people. Mm. So Michelle Norris, Carl O'Donnell, for example, and a range of other academics. So what I've done is summarize that. And just so people know, if you want the really detailed stuff, go and read their work. Pádraig Kenna in Galway as well. But what it shows is two things, I think. The first is that while our housing system was never perfect, and we need not be rosy tinted glass nostalgics about it, there was a period of time where it was less dysfunctional than it is today. Mm. And that's partly because the state built far more social housing for a wider income mix of people. But also in terms of owner occupation, private bank lending, as we understand it today, wasn't available to people. There was much greater controls. There was much greater levels of state support in terms of low interest loans and grants, which meant that people who weren't eligible for social housing were still able to access secure, affordable homes. Mm. But there's another important lesson about the history, and that chapter begins with the Land League, which some people might think is an unusual place to start. But for me, it's the beginning of kind of the movement for modern housing in Ireland, because what you see when you look at the history of change in housing policy is it's not led by politicians. It's not led by civil servants. In the main, it's led by people who aren't able to access secure and affordable accommodation because of difficulties in the housing system at that point in time. And they begin to get angry and they begin to get mobilized. And then they build alliances with good politicians and academics and journalists and public servants. And they build a critical mass of people demanding change. And that forces change. So the history section isn't just important to know what we did better in the past, but also when things improved, who made them improve? Why did they improve? Because I think there's a lesson for us today in that as well. Mm.
And do you think there's a reason why we aren't close to that critical mass right now?
I think we're closer than people realise. One of the world's leading housing policy experts, who I quote at the end of the book, David Clapham, he's been studying global, you know, housing systems in countries and globally for decades. And he had this theory, what he called path dependency, which is in any institution, particularly one as big and as expensive as a housing system, change is slow to come, right? People just get used to certain ways of doing things and vested interests become entrenched. But there becomes these critical turning points where things get so bad and anger and mobilization and the demand for change gets so strong that things shift. And in a book he published just at the very end of last year, he asks in the introduction, and this guy is looking at housing systems everywhere, so he's far more knowledge than the three of us have combined. And he asks the question, knowing what he knows in all of these different countries, are we approaching one of those turning points? Now, some people might say, look, we've struggled to get the kinds of numbers mobilized around the raise, the roof demonstrations that we would all like to see. Mm. We haven't got to the right to water levels or the marriage equality levels or the Together for Yes levels. But that, I suppose, forgets the fact that it took a long time in those three other campaigns to get there. So I think, look, we need greater levels of mobilization, and not just on the streets, greater levels of mobilizations online, greater levels of mobilization electorally. And I think if we keep building those, then certainly I'm optimistic that we can start to force some level of change.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, and you're right to have started with the, I jumped straight naturally is my inclination to the financialization. Yeah, but we do talk about, and at all periods actually when, you know, we were, there's a part about emptying the tenements. And a lot of that was brought by, you know, ground up as well. And it is about social change. And we've seen where you mentioned other campaigns, they've been the people who began the repeal movement began it decades ago. And, you know, some of those soldiers were for the long road. And, you know, they were doing it before it was popular.
In our recent history, the change has always been precipitated by disaster, though. In our recent history, if you go back to the tenements, it was a disaster that precipitated change. And I've said it many times here, and I've said it many times, I feel that that's the only thing that's going to precipitate change in Ireland, is a disaster as a focal point, an avoidable disaster.
And first of all, that's not just a feature of our housing system recently. That's always been the case. I mean, again, if you go back to the Land League, the conditions that people were living in, the impact of forced eviction, all of that, you know, people were dying. And that's what got people so angry and organized. But we are living through that disaster. Like, we've over 4,000 children sleeping in emergency accommodation. The Children's Ombudsman produced a report recently that was subsequently backed up by a number of child development experts in an academic paper that shows the impact on those children's physical, emotional and personal development from spending a year, 2 years, in some cases 3 years cooped up in emergency accommodation. It will impact on them for life. So while it might not be as dramatic as, for example, a tenement collapsing in the 1960s in Fenian Street, for example, or Church Street, that led to a lot of public outrage, disasters can be slow disasters, but they can have as negative an impact. And we've also seen housing-related suicides, whether from whether from people who have spent too long in emergency accommodation. And we've seen, you know, a significant number of rough sleepers die on our streets, who would not have died if our housing system and emergency accommodation system is designed differently. So I think maybe what people need to realize is the disaster is around us. And I think those of us involved in the debate, those of us involved in the Raise the Roof campaign and other housing-related mobilizations know that we have to keep at the job of convincing more and more people to join the dots between their own housing difficulties or the difficulties of their family members and friends with the things we're talking about. And I think the more you do that, the more people will realize, actually, you know what? We need to get out on the streets. We need to put pressure on politicians, and we're going to have a general election very soon. Whatever about the election that has just happened, housing has to be one of the central issues, and change in housing policy has to be one of the central demands of all normal, rational, sensible people when it comes to the election, whether it's in the autumn or in the winter.
Well, the most recent podcast up on site and right now is with Dr. Niall Muldoon, the Children's Ombudsman, and he did speak at length about that policy and his support for the right to housing. And if we can legislate, but if the need for a referendum is what happens, that he supports that as well. So when you talk about that across a broader spectrum of society, it is, I think there's hope in that, there's positivity in that. But what I would also, you know, why we remain cynical is things like people not being able to join the dots between, say, what we're calling now the green wave and the housing movement, because both of those things are inextricably linked. If you want to talk mental health, you want to talk sustainability, well, then it starts with housing. And the special rapporteur says that the pathway to dignity starts through your own front door. Which I feel like we're flying along, because there was so much in the book that you did go through in terms of, particularly around the makeup of Dublin and how these garden communities were born. And we're not far from one here, actually. The first one is just down the road in Marino. So it can be done right.
Yeah, and again, look, I mean, it's important not to ignore the weaknesses or mistakes. So, for example, Marino was a very significant development. But, for example, very poor people couldn't afford Marino because the rents were set at a cost level to try and recoup the loans. So they were really good quality houses for more stable income working class people. And the failure, of course, was you still had huge numbers of people living in the tenements. And when some of those stable income working class families lost some income, they ended up, for example, being faced with evictions, and that led to tenant rights movements and protests, etc. But what that does show is if the state wants, the state can provide really, really good mixed income housing to high standards to meet the needs of working people. And I think one of the things I try and do in the book is kind of say, look, we did this really well at this point in time. We did that really well at that point in time. Okay, we have new challenges now as well in climate change, and how we design our buildings and our cities to mitigate the negative impacts of carbon emissions is central to that. But can we learn both from the successes and failures of the past in redesigning a kind of different kind of housing system? Because I'm not arguing to return to the 60s and 70s, right? For all sorts of reasons. But there are things we did in the 60s and 70s that we absolutely should be doing today, alongside some other things that either have been done in other jurisdictions or have been done at other periods in history in other countries, which if you put them together, you can, I think, design a completely different housing system than one we have, but one that is implementable, that is conceivable in real terms. And that's financially viable, because we could sit here and wish for all sorts of things, but we have to be able to pay for this stuff as well.
I suppose that brings us on to even the headline things that you talk about. I think you're talking about delivering social and affordable housing, public housing is the phrase, really, to tell the truth. We see the government will point now to the LDA, the Land Development Agency, and say that this is their vehicle to do that. And while that still isn't fully formed, it's not going to build anything this year, or perhaps not next year. We won't see much delivery. There is that, depending on the legislation for that, there is possibilities that that could be a vehicle for change.
Well, let's take a step back, and let's go back to, I suppose, what the central problem of our housing system is, which is a double-sided problem. The first is, as I argue in the book, and as most housing academics and experts in the country accept, from 1987, 1988, the state withdrew from large-scale direct provision of public housing for a broad range of income groups. Mm. And from that period on, social housing became a very small part of our housing system for the very poorest in our society.
It flipped from 70-30 to 30-70.
Yeah, and you know, at the high point, we might have had over 20% of our total housing stock, public housing, and it's now about 8 or 9% of the stock. But what's important is the volume was reduced and who it was for changed in terms of the range. And at the same time, you had the entry of private finance into the housing system in the way that wasn't there before. Like people our age, I think, need to understand that the idea that you borrow from a bank to buy a house is a very new idea. It's something that only happened in the 1980s. First the US, then Britain, and then Ireland followed with financial liberalisation. Before that, you had to go either to your local authority, if you were an average income earner, or you had to go to a building society. And credit was very, very controlled. But also, for example, our grandparents, if they bought their own homes and if they didn't buy them from the council as tenant purchasers, about 30% of the cost of the home was subsidised by the state, either through a direct grant or a combination of a grant and a low interest loan. So younger people today are in a completely different situation where the cost of housing isn't determined by what it costs to actually build it. It's as a result of how finance interacts with land and housing developments. And people have been shackled, even if they can afford the mortgage or get the mortgage, would shackle with very, very significant levels of debt. And of course, because of all of those things, the state then increasingly looked to the private sector to fill the gap between those people who couldn't afford to get mortgages and couldn't be provided social housing. So you get rent supplement and then RAS and now HAP. And today we've 100,000 families living in the private rental sector subsidised by the state. So that's your problem. Underprovision by the state and over-reliance on private finance and the private sector to meet social and affordable housing need. So I suppose the big question then is, well, what's the solution? And in some senses in housing, the solution is relatively straightforward, unlike, for example, healthcare or these other more complex areas of public policy, which is the state needs to understand that to have a stable housing system, a very, very large portion of the housing stock has to be non-market. It has to be outside of the market, whether that's provided by local authorities, co-ops, approved housing bodies, community land trusts. It has to be non-market. And that means we need to change the way we think about public housing. It's no longer housing for the very poor in society only. It's for a much, much broader range of people. In fact, for a broader range than was even the case in the 60s and 70s. So lower middle class people should be living in public housing and should be living in mixed income communities with the unemployed, the unemployable, the pensioner, the hardworking bank assistant or podcast show host, the TD or whoever, right? So to do that, you then need to say, okay, so what volume of public housing do we need? And the thing I argue in the book is, the government estimates that we need about 30,000 new homes every year over the lifetime of the National Development Plan to meet current and future need. I argue strongly that at least 50% of that year on year has to be public. And in fact, probably more than that. So that means, for example, if there are to be 30,000 homes delivered, 15,000 minimum have to be public housing. And who will have their needs met by that housing? Those people who can't afford the economic cost of housing. So those people who need some level of subsidy, the very, very poor in our society. Those people who don't need any subsidy at all, just need to pay the economic cost of the rent or the purchase. So I'm trying to kind of design a different model, which is far more about rental. So social rental and affordable rental. But even where you have affordable purchase, and I argue that you should have some affordable purchase in a public housing system, nobody should ever be able to profit from purchasing those units. So the land, for example, should always remain in public ownership. It should be leasehold. And if you want to sell that affordable home at some point into the future, you have to sell it back into the affordable housing system, you know, at the future affordable price, maybe index linked for inflation and home improvements. And that would mean you would move from having a public housing stock of about 8% today, 9%, to maybe about 30%. And the value of that is not only you meet a much broader range of housing need that's not being met at the moment by the private sector or the public sector, but your housing system has a buffer. There's been really interesting research looking at how different housing systems fared when the crash hit. So those housing systems like ours, like Britain's, like Australia, that had a tiny public sector, they fared the worst because they had no buffer to protect against the crash. Whereas those systems that have much larger public housing, Singapore, Austria, Germany, in fact, either some of them either had much lower levels of negative impact of the housing crash or had no negative impact from that. They had other problems like drop in wages and unemployment, but housing costs wasn't one of their problems. So having a larger public housing system isn't just good for the people who live in it. It's good for everybody else because it stabilizes your system overall.
It actually gets rid of that boom bust cycle that we're.
I was just going to say it decommodifies the market quite a lot. It to a degree negates those troughs, those highs. But that's not government policy. I mean, that's anti-government policy. Government policy is to have that hugely commodified property market.
Yeah, and. I mean, the original genesis of the book actually, right, was during the no confidence motion debate in Owen Murphy, because he was obviously attacking Sinn Féin, saying we have no policies, we have no alternatives. And while we clearly do have policies and alternatives, it did strike me during the debate or thinking about it afterwards that actually, do you know what? I think our problem is deeper than just Owen Murphy and Simon Coveney and rebuilding Ireland. There's something at a level below that which we need to excavate and understand. And, you know, a very large part of the book, the kind of the second section, looks at that. And I suppose what's clear is it's not just that this isn't government policy. There is a consensus in the political world and in the civil service world that has been in place since the very start of the 90s. It was first formulated in a really, really important housing document called Plan for Social Housing, published by the then Department of Environment. And the set of core principles around our housing system that were kind of crystallized in that have framed every government housing policy since and the thinking of Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael in relation to housing. Now, it mirrors some very bad developments were going on in other countries like Britain and elsewhere. But it's that idea that the role of the state is limited, that private finance and private development is going to meet the majority of housing need. It relies on this really terrible idea that too many people fell into believing that large-scale public housing is a bad thing, that you have to have mixed tenure, and without mixed tenure, you'll produce ghettos. Something just is factually wrong and incredibly condescending to the people who live in those communities. But also, if you buy into that, it constrains your ability to meet housing need. And a kind of a shift from direct state involvement in the delivery of public housing through capital investment, through, you know, taxpayers, exchequer revenue or loans, to this kind of current expenditure model where you're using, you know, HAP and RAS and leasing to kind of lease private sector stock from various people. So that set of principles has underpinned everything. There was a really significant housing policy document produced by the, again, then Department of Environment in 2007, Delivering Home Sustaining Communities. You had Jan O'Sullivan's housing policy statement and then Alan Kelly's Social Housing Plan 2020 and Rebuilding Ireland. And while some of the details change and some things have got much worse, the core set of policy propositions are the same.
Well, some of the goals shifted to make things even, you know, where so if something wasn't been achieved, they just shifted the goal to make it more. And one of the more dangerous things, actually, and I use the word dangerous not lightly, was the subtle change of saying, so we'll say RAS, HAP and all of these things, they are social housing now, going from, well, they're actually rent supports to this is now social housing. You know, it falls down to, I remember having a conversation recently where someone trying to explain to someone, no, when you see that build figure, that's build, lease, acquire, long-term, you know, all of those things, they wrap them into that figure. Doesn't mean that they put bricks and mortar. And when you get away with subtle changes like that, most people are too busy to understand it, that that's not actually the case.
And the history of that change is really interesting. So Plan for Social Housing in 1991 explicitly stated that local government wasn't going to engage in large-scale building anymore. Mm. Says it outright, and it gives a bunch of reasons why. Of course, what it didn't understand is the consequence of that would be you'd have this growing number of people who couldn't afford to rent, who had never been able to buy, and who'd be on a housing list. So housing waiting list over that next decade rose dramatically. And rent supplement, which was originally designed as a short-term emergency support for people to help them, you know, for a period of weeks or months with the rent, went from being this tiny little fringe benefit issued by the old Eastern Health Boards to this phenomenal cost, as those people who could no longer access social housing ended up being subsidised in the private rental sector. Now, that was an accident. It wasn't meant to happen. And in fact, the health boards at the time and then the Department of Social Protection took over that, didn't want to have that responsibility. They were saying, we shouldn't be providing large-scale long-term housing supports. So what the government did is said, okay, so let's just reconfigure that. And they came up with the rental accommodation scheme. And you'll see in Delivering Home and Sustaining Communities for the first time a rhetoric of subsidised private rental tenancies for social housing tenants as a permanent and deliberate feature of the housing system. Now, you were still entitled at that point to remain on a housing list, and there was still an acceptance that these were short-term supports. The crucial change came in 2010, and it's one of these things that just a lot of people didn't understand how profound the change was. 2010 Housing Miscellaneous Provisions Bill defines social housing for the first time in legislative history. Never been done before. And it actually defines it as a thing called social housing supports, which is council housing, approved housing body housing, land and accommodation for travellers, and income supports such as the rental accommodation scheme. And from that point on, to be in a four-year RAS lease was deemed to be the same
to have had your need met
as to having your long-term need met. Fast forward to 2014, because the RAS scheme was never as successful as the department wanted. A lot of landlords didn't like four-year leases. Some of the inspection standards were a bit too high for them. They then kind of amended RAS to be more landlord-friendly into two-year leases, a slightly less onerous inspection regime, and some other wee tweaks to it, such as, for example, 100% mortgage interest relief for landlords, which you didn't get under RAS. Now, in RAS and HAP, there were some changes beneficial to tenants. So under rent supplement, you couldn't work more than, you know, 19 hours a week, whereas you can work full-time in RAS and HAP. But they could have introduced that reform to rent supplement rather than changing it. And what's the consequence of that change? Well, what it means is, first of all, for social housing tenants, it's what some academics have called the casualization of social housing. So just like zero-hour contracts are the casualization of terms and conditions in the labour market, people are stuck in these short-term, insecure 2 or 4 year tenancies. It's very, very difficult to put down roots, schools, sports clubs, etc. And depending on the volatility in the rental market, okay, you might get a place for 5 or 10 years, but then the next crash comes, somebody wants to sell and you're out. But there's two other big problems with that. It's not just bad for the social renters. It's bad for people who aren't eligible for social housing supports. Like we have today 100,000 households in the private rental sector on social housing supports, rent supplement, RAS and HAP. That means that a third of all rental properties are being basically kind of occupied by people who should be in social housing.
That's right.
That pushes up demand. It crowds out working people who can't afford to compete with HAP levels or homeless HAP levels. So actually, probably the people who lose out most from that are people who are on incomes just above the social housing thresholds, who can't afford or can't secure rental or first-time purchase accommodation. And then it's also bad for the taxpayer. You'll see in the Irish Times today, the Public Affairs, Public Accounts Committee, again highlighting the fact that the cost of this expenditure, last year, if you add the three, rent supplement, RAS and HAP, it's about 640 million. Mm. That's gone up by another 200 or 300 million this year alone. By 2021, if the Rebuilding Ireland targets are met, it will be €1 billion annually. And if you ask government, that is a long-term expenditure commitment.
They set it as a goal, Owen. It's in there. It's a billion.
Right. So my point is this, that change, which seems a bit technical and nerdy, has profound implications for communities and for social housing tenants, for lower income, non-social housing renters and first-time buyers, and for the exchequer and the taxpayer overall. So actually, that's one of the most profound changes that's happened in our housing system in 20 years.
Two quick things. One, to go right back to the beginning on this, that change has resulted in what the Ombudsman said as he sat there, people entering the HAP system to get into the social housing thing and ending up then back in a homeless hub 6 months later when accommodation fails. And you have children with underlying health, mental health issues. They don't feel like they can put down roots anywhere. So that goes back to your initial point. There are people at the bottom of this story that are the victims of this system, and they were deemed to have their needs met. And then the second thing is the government do not have deniability on this, because their own report has said for every HAP tenancy in Dublin that they can afford to build two social and affordable homes on state land. So it's economically incompetent, but it's above all else, it's actually really cruel.
This morning I was just reading an email from a constituent who I've been working with for about 2 years. She was in private rental, got a notice to quit. The landlord was selling up under mortgage distress. She spent almost 2 years in emergency accommodation. She eventually got a HAP place, and within 6 months that collapsed, and she's now back in hostels. And okay, that's the most acute end. But even for people who aren't in that, they don't know where they're going to be in 2 years. And okay, so maybe the HAP market might be a bit more stable. But if you take the RAS market at the minute, right, there's a huge number of RAS landlords exiting the market. So I know in North Dublin City, there's about 200 RAS landlords who are looking to get out. I know in my own local authority area, South Dublin, there's about 100 RAS landlords. And of course, that's one of the drivers of family homelessness, because landlords are exiting the market, whether they're in supplement, HAP, or in many cases, RAS. But the other thing is, even if those families get more than that time, we don't know what's going to happen with the housing market and the rental market in the future, because of the volatile nature of that sector of our housing system, which is why it would be much more stable for everybody if they were in the social housing sector. Mm. I mean, the other thing is you mentioned the Land Development Agency. And see, this is part of the problem, is the Land Development Agency is still plugged into that same policy consensus. So what the LDA is going to do, and we know this because it's written into their founding documents and it'll be in the legislation, they'll acquire land. So it could be the Dundrum Mental Hospital, for example, or it could be some sites that they're currently looking at owned by the housing agency in Wicklow or Dunleary Rathdown or Fingal. And they'll master plan it. Fine. I have no problem with that, so long as there's a good public consultation and it's done thoughtfully and sensibly. What they'll then do is they'll use the joint venture model that is being used out of my own constituency in Kilcarbery at the minute, that Dublin City Council first introduced for O'Devany Gardens and Oscar Traynor. And what that means is they will invite private sector consortia to come in to bid for the job, build out the site, and then the state will buy back, in the case of the Land Development Agency, 10% of the housing for social. There will be another 30% of the housing on average for affordable rental or purchase. The finer details we don't know. And then you'll have 60% of the housing sold at open market prices. And Leo Varadkar was challenged about this yesterday in the Dáil. And he said, oh, but we should be providing houses for everybody. And no, the state shouldn't be, right? There's a section of Irish society that doesn't need any help. Mm-hmm. They have good incomes, they can get a mortgage, they can look after themselves, right? So given the acute level of housing need for people, not only on local authority waiting lists and in emergency accommodation, but for working people above the threshold for social housing, that has to be your priority. And therefore, I've no problem with an LDA coming in and acquiring land, but it should then transfer that land to the local authorities. They should master plan it, and they should do exactly what Dublin City Council is going to do in St. Michael's Estate and Inchicore, which is have 100% public housing development, 30% social, 70% affordable rental, a library, a retail space, a civic plaza. The priority should be to meet the housing needs of people whose needs aren't currently met. And all of the profit that will eventually be generated from that, so when the 30-year EIB loan is paid down and the affordable renters are generating a net income for the local authority, that's recycled back into your public housing system. So in some senses, what the LDA should be doing is acquiring land from CIE and the HSE and the Dublin Port Authority, handing it over subject to covenants for the development of mixed income public housing developments with proper amenities and public transport infrastructure, etc., and let the local authorities develop it. By not doing that, we're going to lose about 60% of the accommodation. And the question is why, right? Because this is really important. Why would they do that? Why would they allow? Because they want it to be off balance sheet. Mm. They don't want it to come from public exchequer funds. So the private consortium isn't government expenditure. It's off balance sheet. It invests. But in order for it to be able to do that, more than half of the units have to be sold at open market prices. So because the state, again, doesn't want to take responsibility, it then will rely on the private sector to meet social affordable housing need. But if 60% of all public land is used for open market price houses for people who can just buy the open market price houses that are available anywhere else, that's not a strategic use of the land, and it will hamper the ability of local authorities and the state to meet social affordable housing need.
In your research for the book, when did it stop being affordable housing, what we knew in the past as corporation estates or council estates? When did it stop being that, where people didn't see any difference where they were living to, compared to maybe a private estate 100 yards down the road? And this stigma of social housing has been attached to it. The reason I ask is I'm reminded of Simon Coveney when he was Minister for housing, and he was asked about council houses, and he said that they couldn't go back to council houses, and I'm paraphrasing here, is because the council houses breeded dissent.
So here's what happened, right? So 1987 is the date, right? So that's the year when they went from producing 7,000 or 8,000 houses, public houses a year, to 700 or 800 houses a year. So that's the precise turning point. But there's a bunch of other things happening at that point in time. So first of all, you have the recession and what's often called the fiscal crisis of the state. So right across the developed world, countries had less money. So they hadn't got the money to spend. You also had deindustrialization. And while we were never an industrialized country, it still had a big impact. So we had really, really deep levels of unemployment at the latter end of the 1980s. And that meant that particularly some of our inner city estates, and St. Michael's is one, but also some other areas, like some of the newer estates like Fettercairn, for example, or Ballymun or Darndale. Of course, they were plunged into a very, very deep social economic crisis because of dramatically increased levels of unemployment. And you also have the arrival of heroin. And these things are connected. And of course, the state failed to respond to the employment crisis, and therefore to the in kind of deepening levels of socioeconomic deprivation in those estates. And the police failed to respond to the issue of heroin, which gripped a number of those communities and like a cancer just ate at their very hearts. So you started to have these problem estates. Now, they weren't problem estates because they were monotenure council estates. They were problem estates because of heroin, because of chronic unemployment and the failure of the state to respond to tackle those two issues. But very quickly, politicians and public servants started to equate that small number of housing developments with social housing in general. Right?
Yes.
So not everywhere was affected like Ballymun. Not everywhere was affected by, you know, in the same way as St. Michael's. So in 1988, the National Economic and Social Council produced this huge housing report. And it was the first time you got an official documentation, a discussion around problem estates. They didn't use that language. But, and in fairness, the NESC report, I think Blackwell was the academic who authored it. He acknowledged a lot of these problems, and he didn't go for the easy solution of stop building council estates. But by the time his more nuanced analysis found its way into the 1991 plan for social housing, the idea was large scale, local authority led, monotenure states produce ghettos. They produce crime, they produce inequality, they produce deprivation, and they segregate our society. And all of that language is there. What's really interesting is Tony Fahey, who was the former kind of head of social policy in UCD, a couple of years after that led this really important research team. Michelle Norris, whom we now know as one of the country's leading social housing policy experts, was involved in that. But they asked a very simple question. They said, okay, so government policy is now claiming that, you know, local authority estates are ghettos and et cetera. Let's go and evidence it. Let's go and study it. And how do you do that? You go and you talk to the people who live in those estates. And they produced this incredible piece of research, which is kind of called the Seven Estates Study, where in Sligo, in Drogheda, in Dublin, in Cork, and in Limerick, I think they're the locations, they went and they did huge amounts of field research. They interviewed people who lived in the estates. They talked to the local authority housing officers. They did all of this kind of stuff. And they produced this report. And the findings are really important. It was published a couple of years after the government policy. And it was a direct challenge. And like I've spoken to Tony about this since. And, you know, they saw it as a direct challenge to the policy consensus that was emerging. And what it said was the overwhelming majority of local authority housing estates are good places to live with mixed income communities that have challenges and problems, but where those challenges and problems are met with good quality infrastructure and services can overcome those problems. That the people who live in those estates want to live there. And there's this wonderful line where, and I can't quote it exactly, but, you know, Tony Fahey talks in the recommendations about, you know, the idea that working class people need an influx of middle class people to make their estates more stable is deeply patronising. And their recommendations are build large scale local authority estates to meet local authority demand and challenge this mixed tenure consensus. Now, I remember asking Tony, so what happened when you produced the research? He said, oh, we were invited into the Department of Housing. It was funded by Combat Poverty, so it's government-funded research. We made our presentation. There was a few polite conversations, questions, and then they never rang us again. Mm. And subsequently, I spoke to one of the senior housing officials who probably organized the invitation, was in the department at the time. And I said, so what happened when Tony produced that research that, from an evidence point of view, completely blew your policy consensus out of the water? He said, oh, well, everybody just thought, well, that's what Tony would say, isn't it?
Yeah,
right? So they just ignored it.
The problem wasn't, and I want to go back and say the problem wasn't necessarily unemployment, or the problem wasn't necessarily heroin. The problem was inequality. And when you have an inequality like that, and then you, as you say, if it's a lack of that, heroin can come into certain, heroin is endemic across society. It's not just for unemployed people, but it's unemployed people starved of, or suffering from a trauma, a loss of identity, a loss of, so, you know, and those things, that's very clear. Those things are related. It's not that these people are in some way worthy or inferior. It's the othering that actually is brought into that.
But here's what's really important, because this is the direct challenge to Simon Coveney, right? And to Owen Murphy, because he says the same things. Come into Dublin Midwest, my constituency, right? And I will take you on a tour of the thousands of council houses, right? We have very, very large local authority housing estates built in the 40s, in the 60s, in the 70s and 80s. The overwhelming majority of them are good, quiet, stable, integrated communities. We have a couple of estates that do have problems, and you're right, part of it is to do with inequality, part of it is to do with organised crime, part of it is to do with poor build or poor management. But the crucial point is this, is that the evidence tells us, and it's not just evidence from Ireland, there's now a growing body of evidence from across the particularly the Anglo-Saxon world, that large-scale local authority or public housing-led monotenure developments, if they're done right, can be great places to live, right? But more importantly, and Tony Fahey made this point very clearly at the Raise the Roof Housing Policy Conference organised by the Irish Congress of Trade Unions in January or February of this year, that if you subscribe to that view of Simon Coveney, that you can't have large-scale public housing, that you can only have 10% public housing and private developments enshrined in the Land Development Agency, it limits your ability to meet housing needs. And therefore, you're tying not one hand, but two hands and one of your feet behind your back, and you're falling over because you just can't meet the level of need that's there. Now, I think the officials in the Department of Housing became convinced by that. Right? I don't think they were being dishonest. I think most politicians actually don't care if it's accurate or not, but it's a handy way of them not having to say, okay, well, we have to spend more money than we currently need to spend. So the challenge is, and again, Tony's work is really important to go back to, if you build really good quality public housing, if you build it in the right location where it's close to employment opportunities, and then when problems arise, if you invest in those communities to empower the communities to be able to meet those challenges while all the time improving educational attainment and tackling some of the historic inequalities, then these can be the best places to live. And again, I suppose that's the argument in the book, is that's the way we should approach housing policy.
But these places were the best places to live for my parents' generation.
And many of them are still the best places to live. And this is my point. So you come to Clondalkin where I live, and the nearest council housing estate to me is a place called the Boot Road, right? It's 118 houses. You know, I'd love to live in the Boot Road. I'd buy a house there tomorrow if I could afford it, right? The next council estate over from there, and the Boot Road was built in the 60s. The next one over is a place called Leyland. It's about 300 houses built in the 70s, right? It is a really great place, right? Like, people will spend, you know, a small number of those houses go on the market. People will spend 300,000 euros to live in that. Now, it's still a predominantly council estate, either with council tenants or the original tenant purchasers, right? The next estate, Lindisfarne, it's an exceptionally good place. And there are two private estates opposite it, right? The house prices are higher, Ashwood and Alpine. They're both lovely as well. But I'll tell you, there isn't a difference in the quality of life from the built environment. There might be income differences between the households and in either estate, but both have lovely green spaces, both have good quality homes, both have access to the local community centre, the shops, the local buses. So it wasn't just in the past. Today, 85 to 90% of council estates are really, really good places that people want to live in. There is a small number of council estates that have a set of problems, and housing policy has to respond and deal with those. But the problems weren't caused by the fact that they were council estates. There are other causes to those issues.
So why are we then back in a cycle where we can't go back to building? We're pretty much right across the political board. People talk about mixed. They talk about mixed. Instead of saying, look, council houses work really well. Many of the older generation grew up in council houses. It doesn't mean they live in them now. It doesn't mean their children live in them. It was what it was designed. It did exactly what it was designed to do. It gave people a stable footing and let them prosper, which is exactly what it did.
And again, that goes back to those changes in the 80s, which is the state not wanting to spend the money to develop those types of housing projects and instead relying on the private sector, whether private finance or private developers. And I think that the central change that has to happen now, and again, Clapham's book that I mentioned earlier, he's making the same argument, you know, and you're seeing over in Britain, for example, at the minute, there's this thing where people are actually talking about the renaissance of council housing, yeah, where you're now for the first time beginning to get the best architects and the best planners and people arguing that this can be the best. You'll see there recently there was a huge architecture, big European architecture awarded, which normally goes to, you know, some big office block or some big luxury apartment. But actually it went to the local authority or the approved housing body in Marseille that runs this really large social housing project for a refurbishment they did. And it's still a block that's occupied by local authority social housing tenants. So there is this movement, I suppose, because we've all experienced this bad 30 years of housing policy, and there's a recognition that there's this growing level of social affordable housing need, there is a movement back in the other direction. I think the challenge for us is both the senior civil servants and politicians in Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, who are in charge of our housing system at the moment, they're still locked into the old failed policy consensus. And again, that goes back to the point of mobilisation. That's what we have to do to force that change.
The big change, and you identified it early, is getting them to accept that they have to spend money in terms of investment in building. It's not, you know, saying we're spending £1 billion on social housing supports is not the same as actually a building program. It's about going to the European Investment Bank and doing something about it. They're the big seismic changes we need to say.
But it's more than that, because what if Owen Murphy was in this chair, he would say, but we are going to the European Investment Bank and we're funding St. Michael's, and we will build and buy more social houses next year than in any year in the last decade. Yeah, and he's not wrong in that, right? They built and bought 7,000 units last year. They'll build and buy about 8,000 units this year. Now, they are additions to the social housing stock, right? And this year, they will probably beat the highest point that Fianna Fáil managed during the Celtic Tiger in terms of social housing output. Mm. Now, the point you made earlier is absolutely right. The number of local authority builds is too small in that. There's a lot of turnkey acquisitions of private developments. There's a lot of purchases of second-hand homes.
We're buying some of them for the third time.
But what I'd say is we have to, because sometimes when I listen to some of the debates in the Dáil, people are letting the government off the hook because they're saying, you're not borrowing, you're not building. Yeah. And they can come back and say, yes, we are. What we have to say is, yes, you are borrowing and yes, you are building, but it is nowhere close to enough. And that's why I go back to the fact that, you know, Murphy keeps saying, well, 20% of all housing output last year are additions to the social housing stock. And I'm saying, yes, it should have been 50. And it needs to be 50 or 50 plus for a decade or more. And your target has to be not a public housing system that's 8 or 9 or 10%, but at least 30% of all housing. Mm. So it's almost about going beyond just saying we need a building program. We need a building program way, way beyond what they're currently doing.
Well, let's put it in very, very broad terms. And they keep saying we can't get back to the madness of the Celtic Tiger, and no one's advocated for that. But they were building 90,000 houses a year, yeah, and now we're patting ourselves on the back for doing 22,000. You know, it is insane, like, that if you can think that in terms of development quality, but there are million euro houses down the road from here that are all sold off plans that literally fell out of the sky. They built the frames and these things were inserted into them. It can be done. It, of course it can, at scale. The likes of Oculon can do it at scale. The approved housing bodies can do it at scale. I do want to move to one thing because I think it is important. We touched on the change from social housing to include HAP and RAS and these things. You introduced a bill yesterday to try and, I would say, undo that.
Yeah, it's a very simple piece of legislation. It amends the 2010 Housing Miscellaneous Provisions, which has that definition of social housing support, to create two definitions. One is social housing. Mm-hmm. Social housing is housing that meets people's long-term needs. So it's housing owned by local authorities, owned by approved housing bodies, or land or accommodation provided for travellers. Right? And the distinction is, once you get it, it meets your long-term needs. And then there's a separate definition of what's called social housing support, which is a short-term financial support for people, for example, in the private rental sector through RAS and HAP, while you're waiting for your long-term needs to be met by what we call real social housing. So the subtitle of the bill is the Real Social Housing Bill. Mm. It does what it says in the tin. The consequences of that legislation would be very significant. So the first thing it would mean, all those people in RAS and HAP would go back on the housing list, if that's what they wanted, right? So instead of having 70,000 households on a local authority housing waiting list, we'd have 70,000 plus the 50,000 households who are on HAP, plus the 19,000 households who are on RAS. Right? So we'd now know
our real scale,
what we need. The second thing is, it would mean those people would have direct access to the housing system. Now, some local authorities, working with good councillors like South Dublin County Council when it was led by the Progressive Alliance with Sinn Féin and others, found a way of doing that anyway. Right. So in South Dublin County Council today, if you go into HAP accommodation, while you're taken off the housing figures, I'm using the inverted commas with my hands here for the listeners, and you're put on a transfer list, you still have access to the primary housing list. Mm. So in fact, you're in no way disadvantaged by taking up HAP. That's not the case in Dublin City, because once you go onto HAP, you're put on a HAP transfer list and you have a different way of,
that's right,
and it adds, we don't know how many years to your length of time. So my bill would mean all of those people would go back onto the principal list. They would have their years restored. So, you know, they would then be able to make the decision. And like, I think it should be a decision. So again, South Dublin County Council is a good example, because the council don't offer people houses. They have an online computer system called choice-based letting. Vacant properties are put up on that and people express interest in it. So if I'm in a HAP house and I'm comfortable and things are going well, and a house comes up on choice-based letting that might be too far away from my school or my work or my public transport links, I don't bid for it. So somebody who's less time on the list than me might get it, but it's because I choose not to bid for it, right? Mm. So if you combined putting all those people back on the list with choice-based letting, which allows people to kind of have a little bit more control of what they bid for, you'd have a much fairer housing system. And it also would then mean that, for example, the government couldn't claim that the Rebuilding Ireland and National Development Plan targets will meet social housing need, because you're measuring real social housing need. And here's the crazy thing. You and I could live next door to each other, two private rental tenants on the social housing list. You're on rent supplement. So you're counted in the government's housing list figures. Mm. Right? So you're renting, you're getting an income support from the state, you're counted in the need figures. I'm in HAP next door to you, paying exactly the same rent. Maybe we even have the same landlord, right? I'm removed from the figures. And it will take me longer to get a council house than you, unless you're lucky to be in South Dublin. Mm. Like, that just makes no sense whatsoever. So what the bill essentially does is defines real social housing, makes it very clear that HAP and RAS are temporary supports, would put all those people back on the list, give us a real sense of need, and also allow those people to access social housing at a time that's fairer and more appropriate.
Just one question, and I kind of know the answer, but I think I have to ask it anyway, because I can hear people saying, yeah, but people on HAP, you know, it's the free house argument. It's that nonsense. But you're going to hear people on HAP are in receipt of this. Do you have a rough idea of how many of these people who are on HAP are actually working people?
Well, the first thing is whether they're working or not, they're paying rent. So nobody gets a free house, right? Like, I was at this gas public meeting a while back. Residents in an estate were objecting to one house in a 200 house private estate being used for social housing. Big campaign. And this one woman got up and she said, you know, who pays these people's rent anyway? And I got up and I said, they pay the rent. I said, so the first thing is, I don't have the answer to that question. But what I do know is the vast majority of people who live in council housing are in employment, mm-hmm. right? And whether it's 70% or 80%, and now that we're moving up the employment levels, it's increasing all the time. What I would also say is that, like, being a social housing tenant isn't the same as owning your own home. Mm. right? So you don't own the house. So there's a set of restrictions on you, like
huge restrictions
that you can't just do what you want. And at the end of your life, you don't get to pass the house on to your kids. You don't own the asset. So it's not like being a social housing tenant is giving you what a private homeowner has, but at a lower cost. Mm. The very opposite. In fact, I deal with an awful lot of cases where, you know, you would have people who've lived in the family home for 20 years. Their mother, for example, who's the last remaining tenant, dies. Mm. They don't get to stay in that house. The council comes looking the keys because they're not the tenant. They're just on the rent. So, you know, people need to understand, people who don't live in or don't come from council housing need to understand, being a council tenant is not the same as owning your own home. And every council tenant pays their rent.
Well, I suppose why I want to ask it is because we're nearing full employment. We've seen the statistic from the CSO last week where 26% of households, 50% of that income is reliant on a social transfer, be it family income supplement, or RAS, children's allowance. So they're clearly working poor. The HAP is subsidising working people to keep the wolf from the door, because those two figures tell you that it must be. Now, they'll tell you there is, obviously there are jobless households, but when you're nearing full employment, they're less and less. And that's just statistically the fact. So again, we don't want to overwhelm people with just going into numbers, because these are real people who are at the whim of the market. But I always reminded what Lorcan Sur said to us when we started this podcast 18 months ago or whatever it was. And he sat down, he said, no, the market is performing, doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's extracting the maximum amount of profit.
There's a really important point in what you're saying. So if you look at income distribution before tax and transfer, we have some of the highest levels of income inequality, not only the European Union, but the OECD.
Yeah.
But if you then look at income distribution after tax and transfers, we're actually at the average. Now, what that means is the state is spending a huge amount of money reducing the impact of low wages in the economy. Mm. Some people say, well, that's a good thing. That's what the state is meant to do. But there are two problems with that. The first thing is through family income supplement, through rent supplement, through HAP, through RAS.
And the new working
family payment. What the state is doing is subsidizing low-paid employers. So that's the first thing.
Yes.
Right? And that has to be remembered. The second thing is all of that money is money that we can't then spend in improved public transport, in improved healthcare, improved good quality public housing. So while I'm not arguing that we should stop in the short term reducing the negative impact of the low-wage economy, everybody loses from that because we're not able then to invest in the social wage and in public good quality public services. And like some of the figures are just remarkable, like the level of public servants, for example, the number of members of the defence forces who are reliant on family income supplement. Mm-hmm. Like, family income supplement is a payment where the state says the income that you were earning from whoever isn't sufficient to meet the basic needs of a family, so we're going to top you up. But the state themselves are guilty of paying, for example, our defence forces below what the state itself says is an acceptable level of income to provide for your basic needs. So there's a real problem in that. Mm. Now, that's a much bigger challenge in terms of how you change the nature of our economy to have it kind of higher productivity, higher wage, that then allows you to reduce the way in which the state supplements the low-wage economy and frees up money to be invested elsewhere. But the other thing then is who profits from that, right? And of course, you know, the person, the landlord who's in receipt of HAP or RAS or it's just an incredibly dysfunctional system. And again, okay, my book talks about the housing system, but the same set of logics work, you know, elsewhere in our public services and elsewhere in our economy. And, you know, people have written books about that. There's research on that, but there are equally significant policy reforms that have to take place in those areas.
Well, it comes back to, and again, I know we've broadened it out and I'm conscious of time, but like you talk about that, it's what's crucial to understand that if we want to talk about, say, sustainability, climate action, you can't have a situation where, as the Ombudsman said to me, he said, the haves are sailing away from the have-nots. And unless the haves that are on their boat are paying more, you can't ask any of the have-nots. So we do need to look at, and housing is a great way to tackle inequality, because you give someone a front door, they're going to start being, I hate to say it, but a net contributor almost, you know.
But you think about it, go back to St. Michael's public housing development in Inchicore, right, which Dublin City Council are going to develop. I met with Brendan Kenny, the director of housing there recently, and then we had him and Owen Keegan, the city manager, in front of the Rockers Housing Committee talking about this. We'd like to see the affordable rents. So this is accommodation for people who aren't eligible for social housing, aren't eligible for HAP. We'd like to see the affordable rents for a one or two bedroom apartment between 700 and 900 euros a month. Now that's in Chicor. Mm. So, you know, it's as close to the city centre, if not closer than you are here in Ballymun Road, as I like to call it.
It's still Ballymun Road to me.
Exactly. So what happens? So those people aren't necessarily then in need of, first of all, that means they've more disposable income. Mm. They're able to spend that disposable income more in the local shops, right? The rent that they pay will assist in cross-subsidising the overall development. So if the state, rather than trying to supplement low wages, provided public services at a lower cost, then people wouldn't need higher wages. Yes. They'd have more disposable income. So it's this continental European idea of the social wage. If childcare was cheaper, if everybody had access to GPs on the basis of need and not on the basis of ability to pay, as we do in Belfast or as people do across in London, then by virtue of the social wage and the investment of the state, people's wages go further and their quality of life improves and it doesn't cost as much. Mm. Now, there are people who need to pay more, although most of the additional tax revenue we should be raising isn't necessarily from individuals. There are high earners over 100,000 who we need to be able to take a little bit more from. But for example, banks aren't paying any tax. Profitable banks, that would raise 200 to 300 million extra euros a year. Intangible assets of multinational corporations, you know, in the first year, if you tax those property, you could raise about 800 million. Okay, it would fall after that, but it's still several hundred million. If we introduced a net wealth tax, now again, Department of Finance won't tell us exactly how much, but if it raised 200 million, 400 million, 600 million. So first of all, there's a lot of revenue out there that ordinary working people, including people on comfortable incomes at the higher end, wouldn't be in any way negatively affected by, that you could generate extra revenue and then invest. And then the crucial thing is to stop giving tax breaks, because the way tax breaks work is, while the average worker gets an extra five a week or five a month,
it multiplies, it's
the higher earners at the top end. And I remember we took a decision in Sinn Féin in the 2016 election not to call for the abolition of the universal social charge. I think we were the only party, because Fine Gael were calling for its abolition, Fianna Fáil were calling for its phasing out, and some of the parties on the left, like People for Profit and Solidarity, were calling for its abolition. And we looked at it and we were saying, like, this raises, you know, 4 or 5 billion euros annually. It's impossible to evade, so the high earners cannot get out
That's
of this
right.
tax, right?
That's right.
And I remember being on the doors with people and they said, but the USC, it's costing me $2,000 to $4,000 a year. And I said, yes, but here's what we would do with the money. So, for example, over the course of 5 years, we'd introduce universal access to GPs, right? So you're paying for your GP through your USC, but you would never have to think about it, right? We'd phase out, for example, over 2 or 3 years, voluntary contributions for university fees or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
And all of a sudden you could see, like, I remember having this one conversation with this guy, self-employed guy, ran his own business, owned his own house, wife had a part-time job, 2 or 3 kids of different ages. And he was kind of calculating all of this, like, what does it cost me to bring the kids to the GP over the course of the year? What happens when I get sick? What are the university fees going to be when, you know, Sean or Moira goes on to university? And all of a sudden he realized, well, actually, for that $2,000 or $3,000 of the USC, if it was invested properly, I'd be better off.
And for how much he has to earn to pay. Like, if he has to pay £1,000 to a university, do you have to earn?
And on top of that, if the kinds of affordable housing I talk about in the book, to buy or to rent, had been available to him, he wouldn't be paying the €1,400 mortgage a year. He'd be paying between 700 and 900 and have a significant extra amount of net disposable income to spend in the local economy, to improve the quality of his life, or to save for whatever he wants to do into the future.
Can I ask, as final question from me, really, do you personally think that there is some social, or I mean, I do, that there is social engineering going on with the property market, that poor people are being pushed further and further away from urban centres, and that there is an impetus by the state to move poor people out of cities, a gentrification by default?
So certainly that's a global trend. And for example, Anna Minton's book, Big Capital, Who's London For? charts that really, really well, right? And you can see it in the numbers. It hasn't taken hold here in the same way for a variety of reasons. I think some of the regeneration projects that collapsed just at the start of the boom were moving in that direction. Whereas, for example, I think the really good thing about St. Michael's Estate is it's the very opposite of that, right? It's come too late for some of the residents who moved out. I think what we have to warn against is we have some very, very poor quality public housing, older 1930s, 1940s apartment stock in the city centre. And there's now a conversation in Dublin City, which I'm not directly involved in, about the future of that. Whatever the future of those blocks is, whether they're refurbished or rebuilt, or it has to be on the basis of the people who live there get to remain there. And if there's anything extra, that's fine. Mm. But the communities there have to be preserved. And I think hopefully there's strong enough political voices in Dublin City Council to prevent that. Our real problem, however, is everybody has been leaving the city centre for the last decade. If you look at the census from 2011 to 2016, they do these great maps showing population changes. Of course, we all hear about rural depopulation and rural decline, and that's true in certain sections. The biggest population decline between those two census was in our city and town centres. They emptied. Now, they emptied either A, because housing was cheaper in the suburbs or in the commuter belts. They emptied because people had this idea that you could get a better quality of life, you know, access to school, etc. They emptied because there was fear of crime and other things. So I think the challenge is, even though we haven't been hit in the same way as that social engineering or urban engineering that clearly has affected other big cities, we're now at a point where government policy is talking about a return to the city and rebuilding our cities. But let's do it in a way that doesn't repeat those mistakes. And that poses some big challenges. So, for example, it means we're going to have to stop building houses inside the canals. Mm. Full stop. Right? People don't want to hear that, but we have to start building good quality, mid-rise, mixed-use developments for mixed-income communities. And that means 6 to 8 stories. That means shops on the ground floor and libraries and schools and apartments upstairs. That means we need better investment in public transport. But, you know, I'm seeing some developments around the city which are on high-frequency transport hubs, and politicians are complaining about 6 or 8 stories. And it's like, you know, if we want to make our cities really good places to live, and if we want to meet our climate change targets, I'm not saying individual developers or individual developments are good or bad. We have to change the way we think about the city. And that means building really good quality public housing to meet social affordable need at density and with appropriate infrastructure and facilities in our city centres. And, you know, if I was in charge of Dublin City's development plan, I'd want everything built within the canals from now on. I'd want everything built 6 to 8 stories. I'd want a completely different way of thinking about the city. And I think we start to move in that direction. I was in Berlin, for example, a couple of weeks ago, and everything's 6 stories right now. Wonderful public transport system, good amenities, good infrastructure. The city has its problems and there are areas of poverty and inequality. But walking through that city, I didn't get a sense that this was high density, cramped, difficult to live in. I got a sense that this is a really good city, notwithstanding its difficulties and problems. Okay, we're not New York. We're not Singapore. We're not going 22 stories high. But people need to realize it's 4 to 6 to 8 stories from now on inside our urban cores, Dublin and Cork and Galway. The question is, what kind of housing? For who? Built at what cost? Rent or sold at what price? And I think if we get those things right, we could have a much better city in a decade's time.
Well, thank you very much for coming and having a chat with us. It's been really interesting. Now, Tony has been reading your book avidly, and he has been relating it to me and telling
Smart
me what I need.
Can't read anything. It's not on Twitter.
And telling me what I need to know. And I think I'm just going to have to sit down and read every word now.
Well, just to say, look, the purpose of the book is to try and inform people. Most of the ideas in it aren't mine, right? Mm. Like, I've been really, really fortunate, both on the Oireachtas Housing Committee and as part of the wider debate here, to be part of, I think, a really exciting community of people interested in housing, from the activists on the ground to the academics in the universities to the good journalists and people like yourselves. So I've tried to distill a lot of that. It's about equipping people with understanding the problems, but also outlining ranges of solutions. And the book doesn't just talk about housing. It talks about planning. It talks about land. Mm. It talks about the legal right to housing. It talks about housing inequality for travellers, for migrants and minorities, for people with disabilities. And it tries to kind of set out a credible pathway for the future. All royalties for the book do go to inner city helping homeless, and it's important because, you know, this is part of a campaign to try and tackle problems of the coal face. But crucially, Raise the Roof for me is so important because we can all do our own little bit in our different silos here in Tortoise Shack or me in the Oireachtas Housing Committee or whatever. If there isn't a space and a platform where we all gather together and we show our growing strength to demand change, our efforts won't have the same impact. So all I'd say to anybody who's listening is, please keep doing what you're doing if you're involved in housing activism, but connect into Raise the Roof as well so that we can grow that movement and we can do in the next general election what we did with water at the last one, which is force policy change on Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael so that maybe finally we can start to see real investment in good quality homes for people whose needs aren't currently being met.
Thanks again.
Owen O'Brien, thank you very much. Owen has kindly provided us with two books, two copies of his book Home, and we will have the details for that up on our Patreon links. So all you got to do is head on over and we'll be giving them away. Thanks very much for listening, folks. Take care. Bye-bye.